It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, state lawmakers in the Assembly have clashed over a set of criminal justice bills. We'll talk about the proposed legislation and the debate among lawmakers. First, some people say you feast with your eyes first. If that's the case, our Food Friday guest has got it down. Her Instagram feed is filled with a stream of beautiful meals, desserts, and snacks, all recipes developed, styled, and photographed by her. But just because the food looks pretty doesn't mean the recipes have to be complicated. Her latest cookbook focuses on meals that can be filling, healthy, and fast. Tegan Gerard is the blogger behind Half-Baked Harvest. Her second cookbook is called Half-Baked Harvest Super Simple. More than 125 recipes for instant, overnight, meal-prepped, and easy comfort foods. Tegan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
We have an origin story that you share in your book. You came from a big family, and you started cooking for them at an early age. Talk about how that set the stage for your cooking.
I came from a big family, and dinners were always really crazy when I was a kid, and we would eat super late at 9:30, and I kind of just got sick of it one day and started cooking to help out a little bit, and I just never stopped. So, it really provided an outlet for me, and it was fun, and I enjoyed it, so never stopped.
Yeah, some people might have taken that experience and turned away from cooking as a chore. You clearly had fun with it, though, it sounds like.
Yeah, I have a lot of fun with it. It's I enjoy putting recipes together and making them look delicious. And it's a good creative outlet for me. I do well with it.
And you like to create recipes that aren't just good and fairly easy. They always seem to look really good. How do you pull that off?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, people, we all eat with our eyes first. So if anything doesn't look that appetizing, you're not going to be very excited to make it. So I always try to incorporate some colors into my recipes and, things that are going to pop out to the eye and really scream, eat me. So.
And speaking of inspiration for recipes, it seems like you're always creating new recipes for your book, for your blog. Where do you get your inspiration from to find new and different twists?
Yeah, so I have five brothers, and we all kind of travel a lot, and so travel is a big inspiration for me. But everyone in my family, from my brothers to my cousins, and friends, everybody's always sending me photos of dishes that they're getting from literally around the world. So I get a lot of inspiration from family, and really the seasons as well. I love to cook seasonally, and right now it's winter, so you'll see a lot of cozier recipes and all the things that we're really craving. And then in the spring and summer it's lighter, so I get a lot of inspiration from the seasons and try to get creative with the ingredients that are available to everyone.
Now, I got to ask, when you get together with your siblings, is there an assumption that Tegan's going to cook?
Oh, yeah. It's not really. There's just no question. Tegan's cooking always. So, yeah.
Talking to Tegan Gerard from Half-Baked Harvest. Her new cookbook is Half-Baked Harvest Super Simple. More than 125 recipes for instant, overnight, meal-prepped, and easy comfort foods. Tegan, before we dig into some recipes that you've shared with us, can you give us some basics, things to have in our kitchen, our pantry, so that we're maybe ready to go with key recipes on a moment's notice?
Yeah, sure. So I use a lot of pesto in my recipes, because you can either make it yourself or you can buy a really great jar of pesto at the grocery store. And that adds so much flavor to just a simple pasta, a soup, anything. So I love to keep pesto on hand. I love to have beans on hand for an easy protein that is in your pantry always. And let's see what else, canned tomatoes to do a quick soup recipe or a quick pasta recipe. And any kind of dried goods, rice, pasta, those are all essentials for me. And of course, good olive oils and vinegars to make really great dressings and sauces. And I mean, I could go on and on, but those are my staples for sure.
Now, a lot of people have been in this situation. I know I have. We get home from work and we want to have dinner made in a half hour or so. What are some of the things you like to do in advance for that scenario? Stuff where you can go from zero to meal in 30 minutes or less.
Yeah, I think it really helps if you could take some time on Saturday or Sunday. I know everybody says this, but take some time on Saturday or Sunday and kind of plot out, or not even plot out, just prep some food, just whether that's chopping vegetables so you can easily throw together a quick dinner, or even making a recipe kind of start to finish so that all you have to do is reheat it or getting the base going. It really helps if you can take a couple hours on Saturday or Sunday to prep for the week ahead. And maybe that's just you're prepping three meals and you're going to, you know, wing it the other two nights or whatever. But it really helps to just have a start so that you don't come home completely overwhelmed, not knowing what you're going to make. I think that really helps.
Let's check out a recipe. You've shared a few with us, and we've got them online at WPR.org/Food Friday. This one sounds like a great fit for a cold Wisconsin day, a broccoli cheddar soup, but then with some seasoned pretzels sprinkled on top of it. Talk us through this this recipe. I love broccoli cheddar soup. What goes into yours?
Yeah, who doesn't love broccoli cheddar soup, right? It's the ultimate comfort food. Yeah, I mean, that one is really one of my favorite soups. There's broccoli, there's cheddar, it's creamy, it's super delicious. There's lots of fresh herbs like thyme. But yeah, the pretzels kind of really set it apart from something different. And they have like some sesame seeds on there, and they really give the soup a nice crunch with every bite.
That sounds really good. And actually, in the intro to your book, you mentioned that some of your recipes have a good amount of cheese, which we're going to embrace mm-hmm. here in Wisconsin. What are some of your other favorite ways to integrate food into your, or cheese, sorry, into your cooking?
Oh, man. I think that if you looked at any of my recipes, you would see it's very easy for me to incorporate cheese. I mean, I love to use it to make soups creamy. I love to use it to do, you know, top pastas with. Pretty much every, you know, way that you would think to enjoy cheese. I'm using cheese, so.
And let's talk about that. I love that pretzel topping idea, because I've made broccoli cheese soup before, but this is an example of a really simple thing you can do. You're just kind of sauteing pretzel bits with some flavor to add that extra element. Do you look for that kind of thing, that little grace note that kind of pushes it beyond the normal recipe?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really nice to, you know, broccoli cheddar soup, we all know what that is. It's a pretty basic recipe. It's super delicious. But, like, I always like to twist it and to say to myself, how can I make it a touch more delicious or something that has a different aspect to it to make it new and exciting and fresh so that it's not just another bowl of broccoli cheddar soup, because there's a million and one recipes out there for that. And I want to make sure mine is different and interesting.
It is Food Friday. We're talking to Tegan Girard, blogger at Half Baked Harvest. Her new cookbook is called Half Baked Harvest, Super Simple, more than 125 recipes for instant, overnight, meal prepped, and easy comfort foods. You can find that broccoli soup and a couple other recipes we'll get to at WPR.org/Food Friday. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are some super simple recipes you like to make? What is your go-to for that not much time to get it done kind of recipe between work and mealtime? You got to get it in quick. Maybe something you make the night before or put in a slow cooker or Instant Pot or whatever you got. And if you're a fan of Half-Baked Harvest, do you have a favorite recipe you've gotten from Tegan over the years? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, some pizza. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Tegan Girard. Her blog is called Half-Baked Harvest. We're talking with her about her cookbook. It's called Half-Baked Harvest, Super Simple. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite super simple recipes that you like to make? Is there something that when you're on the clock, you know you can pull together quickly and it's going to be a crowd pleaser? Or something you like to do with some advanced prep, your slow cooker recipe, bake it the night before or the weekend before plan? Do you do that thing that we all say we should do, not everybody does, where you get things ready over the weekend and then it's good to go for the weekdays? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tegan, let's check out another recipe you shared with us from the book. the meanest, greenest pizza. And you say in the book, this is a salad on top of a pizza, basically. Talk us through this one.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we all love pizza so much, myself included. And sometimes we need some greens in our life. So this one's perfect for that. It's got like crispy kale and it's topped with a little spicy sesame arugula. So it's very different, but it's an extra cheesy green pizza. So you don't have to feel any guilt eating it.
And this is, the greens don't end up cooked on this, right? They go on after the pizza's cooked.
There's a little bit of both. So the kale goes on top, and as the pizza is cooking in the hot oven, it gets crispy, so it's basically like kale chips at that point, which means that, like, you know, none of the bitterness is there. It turns really delicious and salty. And then right when the pizza comes out of the oven, I like to top it with a little bit of arugula just for a nice, like, spicy touch to the pizza.
That's the topping. Let's look at the dough, because you've got this one recipe that's versatile. You use it for an easy bread dough recipe. You use it for your pizza. Tell us about your magical dough here.
Yeah, that's correct. This dough, everyone is loving this dough. It's a no-knead bread and pizza dough, so you can use it for pizza or you can bake a loaf of bread with it. And it's incredibly simple. It's literally just flour and then yeast, and my secret ingredient is beer, which adds like a really nice flavor to the dough that's very subtle.
And speaking of making stuff in advance, this dough is something we can have just kind of in the fridge for a couple days, in the freezer. Talk about advanced prep and storage of your no-knead dough.
Yeah, definitely. You can. I sometimes keep this dough on hand for 4 to 5 days. Just you can leave it at room temperature. You can keep it in the fridge. It's really important when you're making pizza to make sure your dough, or really any dough that you're working with, is at room temperature before you start working with it. But you can also keep this in the freezer as well for up to like 3 to 4 months, I would say, and then just throw it, or, you know, pull it out whenever you feel like you want to have pizza that night and let it thaw on the counter for a couple hours.
If we don't have kale and or arugula around at the stores this time of year, do you have other greens you'd like to sub in?
Sure. I feel like you can always get your hands on some spinach and you could easily replace the kale with spinach. And if you don't, you know, love arugula, you can also just leave it off the pizza and, you know, top it with some fresh basil.
And then another one of your pizzas, you've got some squash, I think, as a topping. And that's not something everybody thinks of as a pizza topping. How does it work?
Yeah, I love putting butternut squash on pizza. And I made it really, really easy for us with this one because butternut squash can be kind of a pain to chop up. So all I tell you to do with this recipe is simply take a vegetable peeler and make some really thin, almost like carrot strands. So you just take the vegetable peeler and you run it down the squash, and it creates really thin strands of butternut squash, and it roasts up really nicely on the pizza so it doesn't take as long.
We are talking to Tegan Gerard, blogger at Half Baked Harvest. You might follow her on Instagram. Her new cookbook is called Half Baked Harvest Super Simple. More than 125 recipes for instant, overnight, meal prepped, and easy comfort foods. You can find some of her recipes. She shared a few of them with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. Share your own favorite simple recipes at 800-642-1234. Tegan, you grew up cooking for a big crew. Was there ever an issue with the fussy eater, and did you come up with solutions for that, or was it kind of a like-it-or-lump-it scenario?
Oh, I wish. No, I've got a picky family. They really love their, you know, meat and potatoes. They're very basic. So I'm always kind of trying to sneak new things into their diet, still to this day, and just kind of do it in very subtle ways. So sometimes that's chopping up the vegetables really small, or you know, adding a little extra cheese to cover up the vegetables, all kinds of tricks up my sleeve, yeah.
And did you turn them into vegetable fans over time?
You know, they're slowly getting there. They're getting a lot better, and they're realizing that vegetables can actually be really delicious, especially they are enjoying the ones that are roasted and tossed into pastas and things like that. The salads, I have yet to convince the brothers on the salads fully, but maybe we'll get there someday.
Now, you've got a bigger audience now with Half-Baked Harvest. Do you hear from your fans online that they've used your recipes to maybe convert other people and introduce new ingredients to whoever they're cooking for?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really fun hearing from everyone. We have such an amazing community, hearing everyone's stories about how the recipes have really, affected their lives and changed the way they eat is so exciting. And I love to see the joy that my recipes can bring everyone.
Let's check out another one of those recipes now that you've shared with us. This one, a unique ingredient, spaghetti squash. It's a spaghetti squash Alfredo. I've made in my life really good spaghetti squash and really boring spaghetti squash. Do you have any, before we get into this particular recipe, any tips on making sure we make it right and yummy?
Oh, man. Choose a good spaghetti squash. I think if you're eating bland spaghetti squash, it's probably watery. My guess, you typically a smaller to medium sized spaghetti squash is really nice, and you want to make sure that that'll give you the most flavor, and you want to also make sure that the squash isn't super super heavy, because that probably means that it has a lot of water content. So just try to pick out a nice squash at the store, and definitely use them when they're in season. When they're out of season, you're going to get more of a bland squash.
And now your spaghetti squash Alfredo, one way to make this is in the slow cooker, and you cook the Alfredo in there, it looks like, but you're also, in effect, baking the spaghetti squash in your slow cooker?
Yes. Spaghetti squash is one of those things that takes forever to roast in the oven. It's delicious, but it takes forever. And the slow cooker kind of really, it doesn't do it quickly, but it cooks it fully. I always have a hard time getting spaghetti squash to really cook all the way through. So the slow cooker is a really nice way to do that. And it's a very hands-off, and by the time it's done, it easily just, there's like no, handwork involved in it. By the time it's done, it's ready, and the strands really scrape out nice and easily.
And what do you use to strandify, if I can make up a verb, the spaghetti squash and make it noodle-like? Do you have a special tool, or can we just do that with a fork?
Oh, I just do it with a fork. No special tools for that one.
Great. You offer the slow cooker option. We can do it other ways, though, right?
Yeah, you can. You can also do it in the pressure cooker or the Instant Pot, as you might be more familiar with.
Now, the things you post on your blog and social media, as I mentioned earlier, they all look beautiful and delicious. Now, do you have sometimes the experimental phases where you make a meal and, maybe tastes okay, but it doesn't look so good?
Absolutely. Food can be a really tricky thing to make look as delicious as it tastes. So there's definitely a lot of challenges, cheese and things, they can all be really hard. Really hard subjects to photograph and make look really, really delicious. But like I said, adding a simple pop of color, whether that's using parsley or, something, a fresh herb to bring a little brightness to the dish really helps.
Now, I have seen in my life some really bad food photography over the years, even in, like restaurant advertisements. Is there a secret to taking a good food picture?
I think if you can use natural light, that's really, so if you're by a window, that's really, really helpful. Overhead lighting is really, really pretty horrible for food, and it doesn't do it any good. So if you can use natural daylight, that's all I shoot in, and that is really, really helpful. And like I said, just pulling out those colors, figuring out what it is about the food that makes it look really good. Is it the cheese? Is it the vegetables, whatever it is, you want to figure out what makes that food look really good and try to highlight it best you can.
All right. I want to take our last couple few minutes here, Tegan, to talk about Super Bowl weekend. Lots of eating involved. Do you have thoughts on great foods to entertain with for an event like that?
Absolutely. You want to do all the hand foods, I feel like, for the Super Bowl. So, maybe that's, I just shared a new recipe actually for Cajun popcorn chicken. And that's obviously really, really easy. Or buffalo chicken pull apart bread. I also just shared that. So I feel like foods that, are really good for people to kind of pick at throughout the game. And then I also always make like a really nice snack mix. It could be like a Chex mix or, like a whole tray of a cheese platter tray or something like that, so that you can kind of, again, just be picking at things. I don't think you want a whole sit-down meal. That said, you could do a slow cooker recipe, like a chili or, like a really good hearty soup that people can, you know, take out throughout the day and be enjoying as well.
Now, one of my pratfalls when I entertain, which isn't that often, but I end up coming up with some plan that involves me still cooking and working on stuff while people are there. What do you do to plan things out so you make sure, you know, you can have the food ready to rock and just hang out with people?
Yeah, definitely. No, yeah, you don't want to do that. I like to prep most of my recipes completely in advance. So, you know, that you are, something is cooking in the oven as guests are arriving, or maybe you do have it in the slow cooker so that you are completely, like, the recipe's totally done and you don't have to do essentially anything, and you can allow people to serve themselves, especially for a Super Bowl party. It's really informal. So I think that's a great thing to do. And, yeah, just prepping as much as you can ahead of time, using recipes that maybe don't need to be cooked. So that's why, like, a cheese plate is really great, because you don't have to do anything. You can make it before your guests arrive and just set it out. So that's really nice.
Tegan, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me.
That's Tegan Girard, a food photographer and stylist, recipe developer, and cookbook author. Her blog is called Half-Baked Harvest. We've been talking about her latest cookbook. It's called Half-Baked Harvest, Super Simple. More than 125 recipes for instant, overnight, meal-prepped, and easy comfort foods. We've got a few recipes that Tegan shared with us, a spaghetti squash Alfredo, broccoli cheddar soup with seasoned pretzels, and that mean green pizza. This one looks pretty good. You can find all of those and a lot of recipes from past editions of Food Friday at WPR.org/Food Friday. State lawmakers are at odds over a package of criminal justice reform bills that are currently in committee. The tougher on crime bills were introduced earlier this month by state Republicans. Lawmakers in support of the bills argue that repeat offenders are creating a dangerous climate in communities around the state, especially in southeastern Wisconsin, including Milwaukee. Lawmakers opposed to the legislation have argued that the bills could add more strain to overcrowded jails and don't address the root causes of crime. Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
We'll lay out some of the basics for us in this package of legislation.
So this is a package of several bills backed by Republican lawmakers. It was rolled out a couple weeks ago. And I think, you know, they obviously do a variety of things. But I think the overarching idea behind this package is to increase criminal penalties and provide more of the deterrent effect for some crimes, and also getting people who reoffend back in prison.
Let's give a listen to Republican State Senator David Craig talking about these issues when the bills were announced a couple of weeks ago. Here's a listen.
Through our bill, we are going to crack down on soft charging and in areas, sentences that have been provided that have not fit the crimes. Through soft charging by some district attorneys and light sentences by judges, hardened repeat offenders are continually emboldened to escalate their crimes. As a result, our constituents are victimized and our police officers are having to re-arrest individuals and groups of criminals time and time again, and after they are continually released onto our streets.
Cracking down on soft charging, do we know what that means in practice in this legislation?
So that's something that lawmakers talk about fairly regularly, putting in place mandatory minimum sentences for certain crimes. We've talked a lot about that with drunk driving, for example. That's not part of this package of legislation. One of the things that this would do is place a mandatory sentence for repeat shoplifters. So we see that there. And, you know, we also hear Senator Craig talking about repeat offenders. That's a big part of this package. People that commit crimes when they're out on parole or serving probation would have the state would be compelled to revoke their probation or parole after they commit that repeat offense and put them back in prison immediately. So as Craig said, they're kind of cracking down on those repeat offenders.
And there's been an issue with that revocation issue, people going back to jail. Reform advocates saying in some cases, okay, this person's out, they have a minor rule violation, they end up back in prison. And there's been a movement to try to cut back on this. Is that something that people have brought up in response to this proposal?
Absolutely. So actually, a Republican lawmaker, Representative Cindy Duco, brought that up in the committee hearing this week. She said that she didn't want to back a proposal that would send someone back to prison if, for example, they stole a pack of cigarettes while they were on parole or probation. So kind of the level of the crime being committed is certainly part of the conversation for these individuals and a subject of concern for some people that are, raising concerns about the bills.
There's also been other concern. There have also been other concerns raised. I want to give a listen to Democratic State Representative Sheila Stubbs saying that these bills don't address the core issues when it comes to sentencing and crime. Here's a bit of what she had to say.
I ask you to please reconsider the process in which you're going to further incarcerate someone who's never really been given a fair chance.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the argument from Representative Stubbs?
So what Representative Stubbs was saying there is that incarcerating repeat offenders actually isn't a very good way, in her view, to reduce crime. She said that there aren't enough services for individuals after they are released from prison and reintegrated into the community to sort of help them rehabilitate and figure out how to become members of the community again. So they said, Stubbs said rather, that just simply putting someone back in jail isn't going to solve the problem of crime. We need to kind of take a different tack with it. And that's a big conversation that's been happening in the Capitol for the past several years.
Laurel White is the state Capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She's with us to look at some changes to the criminal justice system, proposals before the state legislature right now. Laurel, you mentioned some Republican concerns about this legislation. This isn't necessarily going to be a partisan issue, possibly?
That's right. So I talked about Representative Cindy Duco earlier. She's a Republican. She talked about, relatively minor offenses, sending people back to jail if they commit those during probation or parole. Another Republican lawmaker on the committee, Representative Michael Schraw, who's from Oshkosh, raised concerns about the cost of sending more people to prison in Wisconsin, and also the effects of, doing that when we already have pretty overcrowded prisons in the state. There was a similar proposal during the last legislative session, actually, to do with repeat offenders, and that plan ended up being linked to about $350 million in bonding and a proposal to actually build a new prison in Wisconsin. And he said, if we're talking about that kind of price tag for a proposal like this, where are we going to find the money for that? What things are we going to take money away from? How are we going to prioritize that kind of spending?
Another bill in this package looks at domestic violence. You wrote about this one. What kind of changes might be in the works there?
So another kind of ramping up of penalties there. It would make it a felony to intimidate a victim of domestic violence before they testify in court proceedings about that domestic violence. So obviously increasing a penalty, making that a felony means, more jail time. Supporters of that say that, this is a problem getting people to testify in these cases, and intimidation is a major factor in why some people don't testify. Other proposals in the package related to domestic violence also have to do with kind of providing that testimony. One of the bills would allow testimony to happen via video conferencing or by giving a deposition in a different location and having that being able to be used in the court setting. So kind of trying to get ways to make it a little bit easier on these victims that aren't quite so traumatizing for them.
Advocacy groups on domestic violence have responded at least to some of these pieces of legislation. What kind of things are we hearing from them?
So what they said, it's kind of interesting. It's kind of similar to the Democratic argument about putting more resources in supporting offenders reintegrating into the community. They're saying we need to put more resources into supporting victims of domestic violence in the community, rather than spending money on increasing penalties and incarcerating their offenders, their aggressors, more heavily. Advocates for domestic violence said, the state really needs to be putting money behind things like child care for victims, support like that kind of helps them deal with the situation and move forward and get the support that they need.
in our last minute or so, Laurel. There's a lot at play here in this package of legislation. What's the timeline on this?
So this is a really tight timeline. Legislative leaders in the Capitol have said they expect to wrap up the session probably by about the end of February. So this is going to have to move pretty quickly through the process. That has certainly happened in the past when things have had the necessary support to do that. I think it's also important to mention, though, even if this package of bills does make it through the entire legislative process in that tight time frame, they face potential vetoes from Governor Tony Evers. He has said that he won't support anything that increases the state's prison population. He actually campaigned on cutting it in half. So it could face some pretty steep odds in the Capitol this year.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She joins us today to talk about a package of tough-on-crime bills that are being contested by some state lawmakers. Chicken is the most widely consumed meat in America. It's becoming more popular in other countries, too. That's due in part to the growth of large-scale factory farms, an industry that animal rights groups have been working against for years. Our next guest says she used to see factory farmers as the enemy, but the more she learned about their place in the industry, the more she found common ground and new opportunities to change the business by working with people in the business. Leah Garces is president of the group Mercy for Animals and author of the book Grilled, Turning Adversaries into Allies to Change the Chicken Industry. Leah, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
The chicken industry has been a focus for you for a long time. Can you talk about what made you want to start trying to reform it, change what's happening on our farms in the country?
Well, in my mind, chicken factory farming particularly is one of the leading causes of suffering on the planet. And I really wanted to draw attention to that. It's something we can all do something about and is within our capacity to change. And that's something that really speaks to me.
Can you, in just a few moments, tell us about some of the main problems you see in the way factory farms, as you say, are raising chickens?
Sure. Well, first of all, they're the most number of animals that are farmed in our country are chickens raised for meat. So 90% of all farmed animals in this country are just chickens raised for meat. And they are raised in long, dark warehouses, overcrowded, living on their own feces, never to see the light of day until they're hauled off to slaughter. They also have a genetic makeup that they have been selectively bred over decades to grow really big, really fast, to the extent that many of them can't even walk properly. In fact, 26% of them can't walk well and 3% can't walk at all at 40 days of age when they are brought off to slaughter. So it's just an incredible amount of suffering, an incredible number of individuals, and our country could really do something about that. So I'm really motivated to change the way chickens are treated and change how we eat.
And we'll get into your work with chicken farmers, the chicken industry, in a couple moments. But I just want to bring up one more thing. We often see at the store on chicken meat the phrase cage-free chicken. Is that a meaningful phrase?
It's so not meaningful. There are no meat chickens raised in cages. What's happening there is the industry is playing off of the consumer desire for cage-free eggs. Now, this is changing in our country. It used to be that all chickens that are laying eggs are raised in cages. And that was horrible. And now we have laws state by state that are being passed and company by company that are moving away from caged eggs. Now, there have never been chickens that are raised in cages when it comes to meat chickens. So they're kind of different subspecies. And so they're thinking, oh, people are buying cage-free eggs and paying more for it. Why don't we just slap that label on meat chickens and we'll look good? But there's nothing meaningful because meat chickens are always raised in these long windowless warehouses and have never been raised in cages.
Now, here you are, Leah, challenging the way the chicken industry operates, and people might assume it's a solely adversarial relationship. You against chicken farmers, chicken farmers against you. You reached out to work with people in the chicken industry. Can you talk about what led you there?
Yeah, I think that a lot of activists like me, they think of the meat industry, the chicken industry, as this sort of monolithic beast to be destroyed. But I think we have to change that perspective if we want to change the industry. These companies are made up of lots and lots of individuals, just like you and I. And they're just trying to do their jobs. And these individuals want, for the most part, to behave well, to go home and tell their kids about their jobs, their grandkids about their jobs. But they're constrained. They don't want to be ashamed of what they're doing. But their jobs that they do are constrained by economics. So for me, the key to solving, ending factory farming, ending the treatment of animals like this, is sort of hacking that economic formula where we find solutions where everybody wins. I initially started my work because I just really wanted people to care more about chickens. But in my journey of doing that, I realized it's more than that. It's about reaching across the table, finding common ground, looking for those win-wins. And those lessons can be applied across many, many different social justice issues or really hard problems we're trying to solve.
We're talking to Leah Garces, president of the group Mercy for Animals and author of the book Grilled, Turning Adversaries into Allies to Change the Chicken Industry. You worked with a farmer named Craig Watts and really got a sense of what it was like to be the person who was raising the chickens contracted to some of these big brand names that we've heard of. Can you share his story?
Yeah. So when Craig Watts was about 22 years old, he had this dream to stay on the land that had been passed down five generations through his family. But he was living in the poorest county of rural North Carolina, in Fairmont, North Carolina, and there were few job options. The tobacco industry had fallen out, and the chicken industry came to town. And when they offered him a contract to raise chickens, he thought, this is a dream come true. And he took $250,000 loan out to build the chicken houses. Then the company would drop off the chickens, and then they'd pick them up at the end, and he would get paid for that. And he'd use that chunk of money he got paid each month to pay off his loan, like a mortgage. And that went really well at first, but after a while, it didn't go well because it's a factory farm, and there's chickens wall to wall living on their own feces in darkened, stressful circumstances. They started to get sick, and some of them started to die, and you don't get paid for dead birds. So Craig started to panic, and he realized he had made this huge mistake, and there was no way out. He was all but an indentured servant. And around the time I met Craig, he was at this breaking point. He had been raising chickens for 20 years. He was still in debt, and he didn't see a way out. And I went into meeting him as an advocate for animals. But I came out differently. I came out as an advocate for a food system that would be compassionate to everyone, including that farmer who essentially was trapped in the system just like the chickens.
And that led to a lot of the work you're doing now, helping transform farms, chicken farms, into other kinds of production, the Transformation Project. Can you tell us how that works?
Oh, yeah. The Transformation Project, we launched in November. I'm super excited about it. The concept is looking for that win-win. So when I first went in to think about people like Craig, factory farmers, my first was, let's just get them out of business. I don't care what happens to them. But in meeting Craig, I changed my formula. And I thought, instead of thinking about how to put people like Craig out of a business, how can I help him transform into a different kind of business? How can we use those warehouses to do something else? So he meets his concerns, his demands, his dreams, which is to stay on the land, to raise his kids where his ancestors have been raised. And we came up with this idea of transformation, which is those long warehouses, believe it or not, are really good for raising other things like hemp or mushrooms. And we later worked with a farmer named Mike Weaver who did exactly that. He took those long warehouses and he is now successfully raising CBD oil and hemp, which is blowing up in the market. And this gave us the idea, we need to help more farmers do this. We need to be not just a destructive force where we're trying to end factory farming, but a constructive force where we're coming in with solutions and working with everyone affected by what I see as one of the most destructive forces on the planet, factory farming.
One big change that seems to be happening lately is meatless alternatives that, you know, give the experience of meat. We're seeing them pop up in, you know, fast food restaurants now. Is that part of the transition maybe for some of these chicken farmers?
Oh, I think so. I think we are at the very beginning in the midst of a protein revolution where we redefine what protein means. It doesn't have to come from animals. And that's also the win-win. And instead of thinking, how can I put these big companies like Purdue or Tyson out of business, how can I help them transform into a different kind of business, one where instead of their protein coming from animals, it's coming from plants. And you might think that's crazy, but there are companies doing that right now. So Purdue, which, you know, we have done exposés on and we've shown cruelty within their farms, has switched. And they're looking at blended products where they're reducing the amount of animals in their products and increasing the amount of plants. They're doing like plant-based nuggets. And so is Tyson. And believe it or not, KFC in my own hometown of Atlanta, they did a one-day event where they had plant-based chicken nuggets. And you would have thought it was like just announced, everybody was supposed to show up. And I came at like 10 o'clock in the morning, right when it was opening, and there were lines wrapped around the corner. There was traffic stopped in all directions. You would think they were giving out free Beyonce tickets or something because it was so exciting. And I think it just shows you that people are really ready for this shift. And we have to help farmers meet that transition as well. So we can't just come in and say, this industry is over, I'm sorry, you're just going to have to figure something else out. I think we can help accelerate the transition if we're right there to hold the hand and help that transition happen faster through helping farmers go from being animal farmers to plant-based farmers.
And Leah, if there's somebody in the industry, whether a farmer or in the processing field or whatever, what would you say to them? What could they look for the future of what they're doing now?
I believe in incremental progress. So I think I encourage everyone, whether you're in the industry or a farmer or you're an eater, just take steps in the right direction. So that might mean giving birds more space. It might mean eating a little bit less meat. It might mean thinking about a transition and building a career towards a plant-based market. So I just encourage everyone, you don't have to take, it's not a light switch, not an on and off situation. I think most people, if we took a step in the right direction, the world would become better, not just for the chickens, but for everyone, because our food system affects everyone. So the progress is what matters.
Leah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Leah Garces is president of the group Mercy for Animals and author of the book Grilled, Turning Adversaries into Allies to Change the Chicken Industry. She talked to us today about working with factory farmers to transition away from raising chickens and her efforts to push the industry to improve conditions for its animals. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, it's this month's edition of Mondays with Mike. WPR boss, big boss Mike Crane joins us in the studio. We'll be talking about some of the latest news behind the scenes here at Wisconsin Public Radio, programming changes to look out for, changes, physical changes here, I think, but pretty soon I'm going to be back in our normal but now refurbished studio. You can share your questions. You can start right now. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. It continues to be flu season, and now we have the worry of coronavirus potentially making its way to Wisconsin at some point. Public health experts recommend lots of good old-fashioned hand washing and being careful not to touch your nose or eyes or that general area without washing those hands first. But what about our day-to-day habits that might spread germs, things like shaking hands? An NPR article from 2009 is making the rounds again. They offer some healthier alternatives to the old-fashioned handshake. They're kind of hit or miss, though. They have pictures actually demonstrating their options. Here's one, the Xena. Back, if you weren't around in the day, the Xena the Warrior Princess TV show was kind of a forearm bump. Not the fist bump, but a forearm bump together. It's could be hazardous if you don't know you're going into it to begin with. That would have to become a norm before you try it. They say maybe bring back bowing, a bow or a curtsy when you meet a person instead of shaking hands. I like that. It's kind of a classic. We can give that a try. The wave, pretty simple. Hi, I wave to you even though you're 3 feet away from me. That's okay. This is a weird one. They say instead of a hello kiss, which, you know, ew, we don't need that. A foot smack where you bop your feet together. No, I'm not going to do that. Here, this might be my favorite one, the snap and flick. Hey, good to see you. You know, you snap your fingers, if you can snap your fingers, and point. That is my vote. That is the new handshake, the snap and flick. Also, they suggest instead of hugging, the self-hug. Don't do that. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.